You're listening
to the When Life Hands You Lennons podcast.
But in an entry-level film production, it's one strike and you're out. You're fired. I'm not calling you back.
If your goal today is to make a basket, we're going to make that basket.
The minute you create something, as soon as it's made tangible, you have a copyright in it.
How do I get our guys to sound that big, you know, that full when they do the harmonies?
And I'm your host, Lennon Seahawk. Let's get to the show. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of When Life Hands You Lennons. This is the 80th episode, 80, of this podcast. I just wanted to take another minute to thank you for supporting me and listening and sharing out the episodes. I really appreciate your support, and I love doing this podcast and sharing these conversations and connecting with these industry professionals and sharing their knowledge and their stories with all of you. It's inspiring to me, and I hope it's inspiring to you. And there's no better way to kick off the 80th episode than to have the iconic, the Fat Rat. I've been a fan of him for many, many, many years. And in fact, my good friend from Sweden, who was a foreign exchange student when I was in high school, my senior year, we became the best of friends. We shared a lot of the Fat Rat's music, and we did a lot of car road trips, and a lot of his music was played in those road trips. So I have a lot of memories with her in playing with the Fat Rat's music. Now, the Fat Rat is an icon in the gaming music scene. He's known for being able for giving his music away for free, and he's garnered more than 1.5 billion streams across all platforms. And that is mind-blowing to me, because we talk about how artists keep their music so close and protective and they don't upload it anywhere unless they're going to get paid for it. But the Fat Rat has taken a whole new perspective on that, and he wants to make his music accessible and wants people to download it for free, use it in whatever projects they want, and then even remix them or take them and reshape them to be their own projects. And that's a very different, unique perspective, and look at what it's got him. He's had immense success across the gaming scene. His music has been used in massive gaming events. He's been used in videos on YouTube that have garnered hundreds of millions, if not billions of views. And then he's garnered a huge fan base on the streaming platforms as well. So we talk about why his perspective is like this, what initially started this. We talk about his career as a music producer. We talk about what got him into music. We talk about the famed NFTs. That's kind of the hot topic right now, the boom of NFTs. We talk about the future of NFTs. He gives some really good advice to aspiring producers and music producers, and it's really not as complex as you think it is. It's really simple, and he keeps things very simple, which was really humbling and exciting. Before we get started, I want to remind you to please sign up to my mailing list, as it helps me notify you when new episodes like this are live. I would also appreciate it if you would check out my website. I post blog posts, the podcast there, and I have the projects that I'm working on, and you can kind of get to know me as well. I would also appreciate a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you're listening on YouTube, leave a comment, give it a like, share it out, add it to your playlist. If you're listening on Spotify, download it. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, leave that 5-star review. I would also appreciate a follow on Instagram. I've had so many people reach out on Instagram, and I love connecting with the listeners and hearing the stories and how the episodes on the show have inspired you. So connect with me there. I'm very active on there. Send me a message. Let's connect. And if you or somebody you know would be a good guest for the show, fill out the guest request form in the show notes below, and I'll reach out. Without further ado, let's dive in to my amazing conversation with the incredibly talented The Fat Rat. Yeah, thanks for being on the show. I've been a big fan for many years, actually. And I have quite a few memories with one of my good friends who was a foreign exchange student from Sweden back in my hometown. And your song Windfall is a song that we listened to many, many, many times on road trips and stuff that we took. So I have a lot of memories with your music over the years. So
awesome. Thank you.
It's an honor to speak with you. Again, thanks for being on the show. How did you get kind of started? Let's just kind of start there for those who don't sure. are maybe not familiar with kind of the electronic music and where gaming intersects with music. Give us a brief overview of who you are.
Yeah, there are different parts of getting started. Like there is one is getting into music itself, which is something I simply grew up with. So I started with 2 years sitting on my mom's lap when she was playing the piano and I was hitting the keys. So that was music in general for me. And then production, that was quite a bit later. That was when I was, I think, like 21 years old. I wanted to become a conductor first, conduct orchestras. But then I found this was not creative enough. So I asked myself, what could I do instead? And when I was around 20 years old, I had some money saved for a car. And instead, I then invested it in a music studio and tried to produce music and had no idea what I was doing. And then the third thing that I started with was like being an artist myself, because I only wanted to produce for other artists. That was the initial plan. And my wife convinced me, and that was in 2011, summer 2011. So it's almost 10 years ago now. My wife convinced me. She said, you know, I was in Los Angeles at that time. I lived in for 3 years in Los Angeles. Was working in the music industry and I had some success, but it was still pretty frustrating. Same thing that it's for many music producers I know in general all over the world.
Yeah.
Because you don't really build yourself a brand so much. You don't really build on the success that you're already having a little bit, but you're kind of starting new every time. And it's very political at the same time because there are so many people involved. Some of the best songs I made at that time never got released, and some of the worst songs I made at that time got released and got record deals because they were just made with the right people at the right time. Mm-hmm. And that was a little frustrating. And then you make a song, you put everything into it, but then you have the artist, of course, has an opinion, but also the artist management and the record company and the president of the record company. So everybody's talking into what you're doing. And sometimes I had pretty good songs and they were like step by step ruined with so many people talking to it. Yeah, that was the thing where my wife told me, Chris, you should be the artist. And I was a little reluctant. But then I simply started putting out stuff on SoundCloud without even showing my face or anything. And it blew up pretty fast. And again, I like could repeat success. I did a couple of bootleg remixes. And back then, Hype Machine was a big thing. Mm. Those blog charts, music blog charts. And I hit, in 2012 then, I hit the top 10 Hype Machine charts. I did 10 remixes. Every remix went into the top 10. And three of them went number one, and that built a starting momentum for me. And that's where I started being an artist myself.
Great. Yeah. Back in those days, you know, getting onto the Hype Machine charts could, you know, skyrocket your career. And it did for a lot of artists that came out of Hype Machine. And it's so interesting how that's kind of changed, because now the blogs are not looked at as seriously, and it's all Spotify. How do I get in Spotify playlists and Apple Music, trying to play that game?
Yeah, this is a tough one though, because especially those playlists, I never had the strategy of getting into a Spotify playlist, and I don't know if that's a good strategy. I think that's more luck. I think the Hype Machine charts, you needed a little bit of a starting point, but then it was very much about how the people reacted to it, because then it's automatically more an algorithmic thing. Versus Spotify editorial playlist, that's more a thing of, you know, knowing the gatekeepers.
Yeah.
To have a strategy there, or you have music that does it on its own, which, because I have a couple of great playlists, where I'm at, but I have no idea who's responsible for the playlist. I never had any strategy about it. I never pitched it to anybody, or especially those songs. They're just something, some guy discovered it, and then I was like, okay, cool.
Yeah. So now let's get into where you're kind of the meat and potatoes for you is where you're kind of a pioneer. Well, you are a pioneer in the music meets gaming and gaming meets music. And when I think of gaming music, I think of the Fat Rat, and that has been kind of your pinochle. So, and another thing that you've done is you've released music for free and allowed people to just use it because you want. I was watching your Red Bull documentary that you uploaded to your channel a couple weeks ago, and you kind of, you just wanted that to be accessible to people and people to use it. And it's so funny because a lot of people these days keep their music so close to them, but you have the opposite effect of that, whereas you just want to release it and let people use it. And it's been hugely successful to your career. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Which should I talk about first? The gaming aspect or the
free? Yeah, why did you take this like free version in addition to wanting to make it accessible
There were a couple of things that led to that. I mean, because the main thing for me has always been to just that people can enjoy my music, right? That's what you start for.
Mm-hmm.
And from that perspective, it's kind of surprising to me that if artists start to protect their music that much, probably they think, okay, it should be like fair or anything, like I deserve some compensation for it or stuff like that. But I understand that record labels think like that, because they try to make the most money out of the songs, and that's their job. But I had some really annoying experiences with all that copyright protection stuff. For example, like what we talked about before, this the Hype Machine charts and blogs and so on. So I made an official remix for Chris Brown in 2012 or so. And it got released, but the record company back then, they released it in UK, I think, first.
Mm.
So on iTunes UK, you could get the remix, and that was it. Then some people found the remix there. I didn't even know as an artist, right? I could have promoted it and everything. But then what happened is some people found it there, downloaded it, blogged about it, wrote about it, right? And then people read the blog, the Fat Rat Chris Brown remix, awesome, where can I get it? And they couldn't get it anywhere because it was only in the UK or maybe a couple of other countries. So then people started hitting me up, hey, where's the remix that people are blogging about? I was like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, can I get it? Like, no, you cannot get it because goddamn record label.
I don't own it.
They want some people to have it and some people not to have it. What's the point?
Yeah.
Right? I was like really furious. And I had a couple of those experiences. It's so annoying.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that was the amazing thing, because when I started, then like I moved back from LA to Germany then and decided to just do my very own thing. I also cut all the connections that I had, which was also really interesting because so many people say you need the right connections. Like I had no publisher back then, because before I had a publisher and like three managements at the same time and all this like big overhead, which was essentially like consuming everything.
Yeah.
And then I cut it all. And there was a time where I got no emails, for example. Like, there was nothing happening. I was just making music. And I had the liberty to do that. Mm. That felt so liberating to me. I could simply put the songs out and I could just give them to anybody and nobody in the world. Because with remixes, you have the same problem then again, right? You have like, back then, the copyright systems didn't work that well. So you could still make a bootleg remix and put it on SoundCloud. But that changed again. But when it's all your own music, nobody can tell you what to do with it. So you can do that. It was kind of liberating. So I was probably like overreacting a little bit, like, right? And then the other thing, but also from a business perspective, my inspiration kind of was Google, what they're doing. I mean, when you do a Google search, you don't have to subscribe to something where you can do a Google search, right? Mm, and they offer so many services like Mail, and Maps is like the best navigation, way better than anything in my, you know, in the which you have already in the cars. It's usually so bad compared to Google Maps. And it's all for free. And they just make amazing stuff, and then they think about how to monetize that later. And that was also, and what I kind of also realized is that's another aspect, that the most valuable thing we have today in our economy is attention, right? Because we have so many products, everything, it's hard to put a value on to that, or because usually value is defined by scarcity, right? But since we have so much stuff these days, the one thing that's always and gets scarce more and more is attention. And the more you let your music free, and like you do like Google, the more attention you get, and you get what you actually need as an artist is people hearing your music and knowing about you, and that makes it much easier.
I really like that idea of Google makes so many free services. I mean, look how many people live in Google Drive and Google Docs and all that stuff. I live in it. Don't use anything else. And that's a very interesting perspective. So talk about the process of, like, now, when did you kind of realize, like, this is enough? I'm tired of this. What year was that you were, like, tired of the bullshit that was going on with the record labels and publishers and all that stuff?
Well, it took me a while from realizing that to actually taking the step. It was kind of a gradual process. Yeah, because I moved to LA 2010, and I think it only took me a year to realize. First of all, I didn't like living in LA so much. It's cool to go there once in a while, but living there wasn't really my thing, and not so much for my wife either. And then it was just a gradual process where it was like, I'm unhappy with the music industry, and I want to release something by myself. But then the reason why I got back to Germany was also more personal, because we wanted to have a family, and we thought, okay, but that we didn't really want to have kids in LA, just because we thought it wasn't the right place for us. So it was a more personal thing. And then I moved back, and then that was there in Germany for a while. It was about half a year. That was really interesting because it was hustling so hard for 20 years almost. Mm-hmm. Let me think. Yeah, because I started in 2001, and then was at that point it was 12 years. So for 12 years I was hustling like crazy, and then I moved back to Germany, and I stopped that because I had some success already, and I was living in the village in Germany, and is not very expensive. So I didn't really have to work because I had all those royalties coming in. So I got myself a great gaming PC, and I bought Skyrim and just played Skyrim for 2 months, which I hadn't played before. It was already out for 2 years, but I just played Skyrim. Then I played some like strategy games, and I really took a step back. And then I thought, okay, what could I do? That was kind of the point where I did this exit, but it wasn't that much of that. It's enough now, I'm gonna quit. It was more like a little bit of a, like, how do you call that? You kind of almost like giving up a little bit, but at the same time, also like it felt a little bit like retirement already. I was kind of retiring. I even thought about this because I had the royalties coming in. I wasn't like super rich, but I had enough stuff that I could make a living from it for a long time. Enough royalties and enough like budget. And then, then I got bored. I really got bored. And I was like, okay, what am I going to do now? Because playing video games was nice for a month. And after the second month was already like, that's not the only thing I should do. And then I thought, okay, I'm just going to make the music that I always wanted to make. make the music that's my personal thing, and I don't really care so much what everybody else thinks about it. And that was, of course, very liberating, again, mm-hmm. because I really could then make music that I personally love, and I didn't have to think about, like, what's the market and what are the record companies searching for you, because you get all those briefings, like, okay, we want a song like this and like that, you know, like this artist mixed with this and like the drums from here, da da da. You get all those briefings, and that's what we're searching for. It should be high energy or not so high, like all the stuff. And so it fits in the radio, but I could just do the weirdest stuff, right? Nobody could tell me. And like, my song Monody is like 5 minutes long and has like orchestra intro and like three different tempos and weirdest structure. And yeah, there was nobody who could tell me that. And that was the amazing thing when I kind of gave up trying to fit anywhere or trying to please anybody and just pleased myself. Yeah, so that was a gradual process of getting there.
Okay. And you're currently fully independent, correct?
Mm-hmm.
That's incredible. And what do you have, a publishing deal or anything like that?
I have someone who collects the publishing for me.
Got it. Because like an admin publisher.
Yeah, an admin publisher who collects the publishing for me. Which I trust very much, who's very very collaborative with me. But I always make those kind of deals, so I never take any advances. It's really important for me, because they just tie you to an agreement.
Yeah.
And I usually have them very short term, so I could always terminate the agreement. Whenever I think it's not right anymore, I just can terminate it very short term.
Interesting. So I'm so fascinated by the way that you've merged music and gaming. And when did it really start to pick up for you? And like, when did you realize, like, this is my moment, like, this is my music belongs in this kind of music, and your career really started to like spike up?
So the gaming aspect of it, that wasn't planned. That's important. I never thought I'm gonna make gaming music. In fact, at the time where I made those songs that started it, like Unity, Windfall that you were talking about, Xenogenesis, Never Be Alone. When I made those songs, I had a conversation with my wife back then. I said, hey, what would be really also cool would be if I could make any music for video games. But I have no idea how to get there and how to get in there. And I would have to find a manager again. And so I didn't know. But what I did is I simply made the music that I liked. That was it. And I never even thought about this music getting into video games or anything like that. It was just that happened then automatically. It wasn't a plan. It wasn't smart. It was just accident, honestly. But I made the music that I liked. And since I grew up on video games, so I started with Game Boy and had an NES and a Master System and a Genesis and a Super Nintendo and a Neo Geo and like all that stuff. I was just all into video games as a kid already, like very obsessed with it. So the music I made automatically kind of sounded like that, as if it was like video. It was very, very video game inspired. And then when it took off, well, I mean, the time I released those songs in 2014, I started releasing. Like, I released Unity a year later, a month later, I released Windfall. A month later, I released Xenogenesis. Then 2 months later, I released Never Be Alone. And I didn't even have Unity on the DSPs. No, it wasn't on Spotify. It wasn't on Apple Music. Nowhere. I was just, okay, you can download it for free. And that I changed that a half a year later, which is like the worst release strategy you could do for a song, is put it out there or put it on YouTube and everywhere for free and SoundCloud, and then put it on Spotify 6 months later. Like, that's the, like, if you wanted, like, destroy a song, that would be the way to do it, because then all the attention is already gone. Which is funny, because now it's still doing so well. But then I had three songs. I put them out with a YouTube channel called Tasty Records. So I signed it like it's an indie label based on a YouTube channel, and they put it on those DSPs. And we started, I think, in October 2014, and then sometimes I think February 2015 or January 2015, we were texting, and he said, "Hey, we have the first statements. We sold some copies," and I was like, "Oh my god, it's probably like 20 copies or so." Like 20 sales. He was like, no, it's 6,000 sales.
Wow.
I was like, oh, wow. That was for me the first, I remember that when I read this, it was the first moment, oh, there's something, that could be something. Because I had no plan how to make money with it, because when you just put up music for free, nothing's happening. And the funny thing was, everybody in the entire music industry told me, you're not going to make any money from streaming. It's just too little money you make from a stream. There's no way to it's only be cents, like a couple of cents you can make there. Never it's going to be relevant money. Same thing for YouTube. You need so many plays. It's not going to happen. You may make like $10 per month. Yeah, but then there was when I had like, 6,000, and there was sales on Apple. Right, so I thought, like, oh, wait, that's 70 cents per sale, and we split it 50-50. That's 300.
35 cents.
Yeah, 35, exactly, sale. 35 cents. So so it's like $2,000, right?
Yeah.
6,000 plays.
Roughly.
And that was just, I think that was just the first song that was released. It wasn't even the second or the third song. So that was kind of the moment where I was like, wow. And there was in 2015 was like 3 months where it went from, I was still believing, okay, I have no idea how I ever going to make money with it, to the point where I was like, oh wow, I can really make a living of it, and even a good living. It was also when I switched on monetization on my YouTube. I never had put in the effort to switch on monetization on my YouTube, because once again, everybody told me it makes no sense. Nothing's going to happen. But then I switched it on. I remembered like the first day, it already jumped up to, I don't know, $12 per day. And I was like, oh, wow. And then it got up and even more. And then I was like, hey, this is going to be, could be like $1,000 per month, or maybe even more, even like, especially because the entire thing was moving up. And that was, I think, in March. March 2015. So it was winter 2015, where it was gradually realizing the potential.
It's so interesting, because it seems so recent. And you've done music pretty much your whole career. You've made a living off of music your whole career, right?
Yeah.
So what are some of the other projects that you worked on? Like, you've done official remixes. Did you compose any music just like specifically for original video games beforehand? Or what were some of the other projects that you dabbled in?
No, it was mostly... the first thing that I did is like trying to get into the music industry. I was an intern at a music production company that at that time was 2003, had produced Lou Bega Mambo Number 5. And I worked my way up, like on the career up there. And then I was like head of the production kind of. Okay. So that was one of the first things that I did. But there was the owner of the company. He thought he would be the producer. On Mambo Number 5, he was like the manager who made the business, all the business decisions.
Sure.
And then Mambo Number 5 became this huge success. And then he thought, oh no, you know what? I'm the producer. And that was a disaster. But I learned so much. So I recorded the Class Brothers, for example. At that time, they just were, I think, nominated for a Grammy with a... classical music and jazz crossover with Cuban music. So I was a recording engineer. I made surround mixes for rock bands in Germany. One of the first actual surround mixes for a rock band in a huge studio. And then I was then still working, doing like engineering jobs and stuff. And then when I started, I wanted to become like a producer all on my own. I did a lot of ghost producing for other DJs. In Germany back then, some dance projects. I made ringtones that were embedded in the phones. Mm. So when you bought a Siemens phone in 2006, 2007, 2008, the ringtones on there, I made those ringtones. And the agency that got those jobs, so Siemens was paying 800 euros for a ringtone. And the agency took 750 and they paid me 50.
That's not even worth it at that point.
And I was super happy to get 50 euros per ring. I even knew that. But I was like, because I needed money so bad sure. at that time.
Sure.
So for me, it was amazing. They often called me in the evening and said, oh, we need 20 ringtones tomorrow morning. So I would work the entire night, through the entire night, making 20 ringtones in a row, which was incredible learning experience. Because you learn so much about creativity when you have to do like 20 short songs in a row with no, like, you.
What is that process like? I mean, obviously ringtones are a little bit different these days, but what's it like creating a ringtone?
It's like a short beat or a song. You try to make something that has a alarming vibe, right? So something that people don't. But it's pretty free creatively, but okay. You have to be there's no time to think because you have like 10 hours, right?
Yeah.
Because they call you in the evening or maybe a little more, but you have like 30 minutes per ringtone, so you really just have to do, you have to knock it out. And usually we would go to a certain, and what was so interesting for me is how the quality of the ringtones differed, because at some points you feel like you have no ideas anymore. And then you do one totally incredibly horrible ringtone and another one. And then sometimes you get very creative when you push through that. You do more, and because you have to come up with something new, and there you have no choice, right? So that was a thing. And then I ghost produced a lot. And then I started doing like pop music. I did a pretty successful... produced for a pretty successful girl band in Germany, for example, Monroe's was their name. And then I made ringtones again, but these times they were sold from Yamba in Germany. They did like weird animated short videos, like the Crazy Frog kind of thing a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I love the Crazy Frog.
And I did one that became incredibly successful in France in 2010. René La Taupe, Mignon Mignon. It was also released as a song then. It was number one for 13 weeks and became the best-selling single in 2010 in France. But then in the US, I also did, for example, I worked with Lupe Fiasco. I had one song on The American Terrorist, Part 2, I think it was, which was went number one in the hip-hop album charts. Which was also, the album was nominated for a Grammy. I did K-pop in 2012, I think it was, or 10, and or 11, around that time. No, I think it was 2012. Wonder Girls, The DJ Is Mine, for example. So that was like just pop songs that I did. Everything where I could like make some money, because yeah, especially in the beginning, I really had, you know, there is a lot of pressure on you to do something. And a lot of library music as well, which was almost the best, because they would give you a briefing. They would say like, hey, we need a song that's a little bit like this or a little bit like that. And you had a lot of creative freedom. The deadlines were okay. And the library music, the cool thing was that is that it makes money over a long period of time. Yeah. So you put it in the library and then you get all the publishing and royalties and everything. And mm-hmm. I did a lot of library music. And that was just a steady income stream that I had. That was almost the reliable income stream that I had then. Mm-hmm. Where I was like, okay, this is what I'm going to make every year. And every 3 months I get this, my royalties. And that's just my foundation of my income. Mm. Yeah, so tons of different things.
Tons of different stuff. And it's just like a lot of musicians and producers are got to hustle. They do whatever they can to make money, even though it's a little bit. You do what you got to do to pay the bills.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm curious. Have you ever been out in public and then you hear somebody's phone go off with a ringtone that you made?
No, not with the ringtones. It's probably just because I'm not so much out in public.
Sure.
Most of the time in the studio. Yeah. Not the ringtones. I saw this, like, the stuff that would, those ringtones that you could buy them, they were advertised on TV back at that time. Mm. And yeah. I saw those advertising quite a bit.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I just thought that would be an interesting thing. Like you're in the grocery store or something and you hear somebody's phone going off and it's like, I sounds familiar. I made that.
Yeah, I had a colleague that was really funny. A friend of mine, he did the same thing. He was also making ringtones for them. And we were then sitting in the studio with somebody else about a year later. And someone's phone went off and it was that ringtone where he made. The funny thing was that he said, oh, wait a second, they never paid me because I think he only made a set of ringtones once and they got paid him saying, no, we didn't sell any of these. And then he heard that ringtone. He was mad.
I bet. That could be a potentially a lot of money.
Yeah. And so this studio/agency, where I made this with was pretty shady company.
That's too bad. There's too many of those out there these days. So watching your documentary, the Red Bull one, and Gustav Kahl from Enter Records, he mm-hmm. said that you're the most influential artist in the whole industry, in the gaming industry. Yeah. What do you think of that?
The question is what would be influential, but I mean there's maybe something to it in the sense that I hear quite a few sound-alikes of my songs. So I've been in this position for so long where people told me, like the library music, like, oh, we need a song like this, or we need a song like that, and there are tons of like pretty obvious rip-offs from my music that I get to hear, like some trailer music or some, like in the mobile games, it's like they take my music and they change it a little bit and then put it in there. So it's a little bit like copying my stuff, which is, by the way, totally fine for me. So I have absolutely no problem with that. But that's for me where I see, okay, I actually find it kind of cool because it shows me how, that I'm influential, that I'm like, you know, now I'm the one who's making the templates for other producers and they have to copy it, which I often started like that, right? Mm. Where people told me, hey, we need something like this, we need something like that.
So where do you draw the line, if you have one? Because you have, your music is so accessible, millions and millions and millions of views on YouTube. I mean, across all streaming platforms, so many views and listens. So what if somebody wants to use your song in a video game or in a trailer? How do they use it for free? How do you collect the licensing fee? Like, what is that kind of process for you?
It's different things. So anything on socials is always free to use, right? So okay. If you want to put it on, like, and in that case, it doesn't matter if it's a company or it's just private. So if you want to use it on YouTube or like Instagram, Facebook, those social stuff, and you want to use my music in the background, that's fine. Well, when it's like big companies, I usually ask them to pay for that. But it's only like the big companies. Everything that's like small businesses or, you know, independent people, I always give it them for free. And with games, what I do is I'm okay when games use my music, and when it's like starting developers and people, yeah, or people who just start, independent developers, I give it to them also for free.
Sure.
What I do then is I tell them, hey, if your game really blows up, let's talk again, right? And what I do then is I tell them, because that already happened a couple of times, that a game really became huge, some like with hundreds of millions of downloads.
Oh, wow.
And then I get back to them and tell them, it's not like, here, pay me. But what I tell them is, you know, I give another 4 months of free use of the music. So you can use it another 4 months for free. But if you want to keep using it, let's find a solution, right? Mm-hmm. But if not, you have like 4 months where you can, or if you need it, maybe 5 months, whatever, right? But then find something else. Because if you have like 100 million downloads on your game, and you want to still use my music, then now you really have the money to pay me.
Yeah. Right?
Because often I know, because my brother, he developed 2 games independently. He's now working for Ark Survival. I don't know, the dinosaur game. But he did 2 games independently. I know it's, you know, when you're starting, you're happy for every cent that you can save, right? Because it's also... money's very critical. So I don't want to go around like, hey, pay me $100 or like $200 for using my music. I'm just, you know what, just keep it or just use it and have fun. You can use the entire catalog. It's totally fine from my side. And that's how I handle that. And so far, every developer has been really thankful and really happy, because then when they blow up and I tell them, hey, let's find a solution, then they are more than happy. They say, like, okay, we're making tons of money. Now it's, of course, we're going to give you some.
And what does that solution typically look like? Is it like for every 10 million downloads or 5 million downloads, you pay me X amount of dollars? Or what does that typically look like?
No, it's typically a yearly license. Ah. So it's just a fixed amount for a year of use for one game or several games. And then we renegotiate.
Okay, keeping it simple then.
Yeah.
For sure. Cool. So I want to get into kind of a hot topic today, and this was one of the topics that your manager sent over, was NFTs. And that's kind of a big topic. Everybody's talking about them. I go on Clubhouse, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, everywhere you go, and somebody's talking about an NFT. So tell us about NFTs, for those who don't know what that is. It's a non-fungible token, but can you explain a little bit what it is and maybe how you're going to be working with them or have worked with them?
I haven't worked with them yet. I find them very, very, very interesting. Yeah, it's a non-fungible token. It's in the Ethereum blockchain. Ethereum, it's the difference between Ethereum and Bitcoin is that Ethereum is basically a programming language blockchain where you can do any sorts of data processing versus Bitcoin, which is kind of sometimes called digital gold. So it's just one resource that you can like say, okay, I have so much here and someone's going to get this and someone's going to get this. But Ethereum, you can do all sorts of information processing in the blockchain. So you can also put like files and data into the blockchain or tokens, unique, non-fungible tokens into the blockchain and then sell them. So you have an original of any data. Which could be a video, could be a song, could be an artwork. And yeah, that's what people do. So then you can sell that. And I think it's incredibly important or a revolution, especially for visual artists. Mm. I mean, it's funny because I know the guy who brought Beeple to Nifty's. And when you... So I watched this pretty closely. And I've been a fan of Beeple for a long time.
Same.
And when you watch videos that are just 1 year old, it's so interesting. He's like I think even doing a podcast or something that I saw. And people have asking, hey, like, what's what he would wish for the future? And he was like, yeah, you know, I'd like to focus more on my own stuff because I have to do all those jobs to make a living. He would just have like was working for agencies and, you know, basically like me, like, so you have other people telling you what to do. Mm-hmm. And I have to do all those jobs to make a living, and I would love to just make my own art. But yeah, maybe it's going to get there someday. And yeah, and now he sells like he's getting $69 million in one auction. So that's a total game changer for them. Yeah, but also of course for musicians, it's different. I'm planning to do something. I'm curious how it's going to work. Because for me, it's not the core of who I am. For me, like you said, the core of who I am is that my music's for free. It's mm-hmm. not so much that. But then again, that was the same for Beeple. He gave everything away for free. He even gave away, just like me, he even gave away the project files for free. Mm. Right? And that's what I did. I often or usually give away the stems so everybody can see what I did. Everybody can modify it, make something own out of it. So yeah. But it's not for me personally. It's, what remains is I want as many people to hear my music and use my music and have fun with my music as possible. So it's not the core identity of me. It's not probably not going to be non-fungible tokens, because that's all about scarcity, right?
Mm-hmm. So do you think that they're kind of here to stay, or do you think they're going to keep their value, or do you think this is just kind of like a passing fad?
It's hard to say. I think those things, if you would know that for sure, you could make incredible decisions. But those things, you never know. I mean, so many people said that Bitcoin was just a fad. And when there was this boom 2017, I think, end of 2017, right. Then it went down again. It was like, yeah, see, we told you. Well, look at where Bitcoin is now. Like, it's
60 way, grand US way, dollars.
Huh?
It's like 60 grand. And now Tesla just announced you can buy cars with it.
Yeah.
It's like,
it's insane. It's, yeah. So, yeah, so many people said that was just a fad. So, yeah, I think it could be a very big thing. I mean, but you never really know for sure. I think my wife just bought a Galantis. Galantis had a drop, you know, the Swedish band. They had a drop yesterday. I think my wife bought some Galantis NFTs yesterday. Yeah, but yeah, I don't know for certain what the future is going to be like.
Yeah. It's just like the last month or two is just totally blown up. Yes. And it just came out of nowhere. It's like, they've always kind of existed, but then they just, especially in the music industry, they just caught on.
Yeah.
And it's just like the hot topic of today. And it's like, what even is this? It's like, I haven't even had time to really learn about it because there's so much of it coming in and like learning, and things are changing, and every now there's going to be 600,000 new companies that are specializing in, you know, NFTs, and it's like overwhelming almost.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. It's really crazy. Yeah. I think, especially as an artist, especially with those agencies and stuff, you have to be careful. Who you work with, that's one thing that's for sure, because yeah, they're coming just like the record companies. As soon as there's a lot of money involved, a lot of people who are not actually contributing anything are trying to get their share. That's where you have to be careful. But I have a guy that I work with, the guy who brought Beeple to NFTs, and he's cool. I'm happy that I'm with the right person there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always good when you can get somebody that you trust and rely on, especially when you're dealing with something as new and technology driven as NFTs. It's very, very helpful. So what, last couple of questions here before we wrap things up. I'm just curious, what's kind of the most, what do you view as like the most amazing part of your career? Like, what is it? Was there a specific moment in time that you always kind of reminisce back to or look back to, or is there something that's coming up? What kind of stands out to you in your career?
That's a good question. I would say it's every day. It's made so being an artist in general, because like I said, I've been a producer before, and the difference is night and day. It's so different having that creative freedom where I'm the person deciding what music I make and what music gets to be released. And it's still that feeling that I make a song and then being in the studio making the song and knowing I can, this song's gonna be heard. It's still amazing to me because it had 10 years where this wasn't the case. It wasn't in the studio making a song. You know how it is. You make something amazing. You're creative. You're like, this is it. And nobody ever hears it because the record company is like, oh, you know, yeah, that's really cool, but I don't know if that fits on the radio at the moment. You're like, okay, cool. Well, I'm just going to throw it away and work 2 weeks on it or even longer. And yeah, let's forget about it. Let's move on. And yeah, can you make something like this? And yeah, like, I don't like that, but yeah, if it pays the bills, I'm going to make that. So that difference is day and night. And I'm just incredibly thankful every day that I'm in this position, that I can just make the music that I like and make a living from it and make a pretty good living from it, just by being creative and just doing the art that I like. That's an incredible position to be in.
I know, so a lot of artists and producers aspire to be living entirely off of their music. So it's definitely inspirational to hear, you know, your hustle that you had and now to where you're at now.
Yeah, it was a long hustle. But yeah, now then in the end, it's worth it. And it's funny because I never expected it to go like this, to be an artist myself in the first place. That was not the plan. And then doing it completely independent also wasn't the plan. And for me, it was really... Overall, this breakthrough, it was so interesting for me because it came when I stopped grinding. It all came when, because before I was working like 14 hours per day, and then it went down to 4 hours per day because the other 4 hours I was still playing Skyrim. And I wasn't like doing any business at all, even. So it was just a couple of hours per day where I was just making music when I felt it. But looking back, it kind of makes sense because when you do, like, I was only making music when I felt it, and I was only making the music that I absolutely loved and liked.
Yeah.
And it kind of makes sense that then you create something that other people like as well. Rather than you just sit down and think what could theoretically be successful, and even when you don't like it yourself, you force yourself to create it, it kind of makes sense that probably what comes out of it is not that good. So overall, that development was very... it was also a game changer for me because I just realized that it's not so good to force it, just to... You know, just follow your instincts.
Good advice. So what's a day in the life look like now? Are you still playing video games all the time? Are you focused more on music? Or
no, it got less and less. I still play video games. Like, I play them every day, but usually about an hour, and together with my daughter, just because we have a lot of fun with it. Sure. We go actually into the studio here. I have here, look, that's my Switch.
There you go.
And so we play Bowser's Fury at the moment. But that's okay. Like about an hour per day. And not even every day, actually, now that I think about it. Because I just like making music so much that it's, I'm more focused on that. And yeah, I usually stand up. I mean, today it was early because I stood up at 4:30 a.m. Usually it's 5:30 a.m. I stand up, make some morning routine, like workout a little bit and some journaling. And then I start making music. Just go straight into the studio and work for a couple of hours. Then have breakfast, work a few hours more and till the afternoon. And then my daughter comes home at 3 p.m. or something like that. And then I spend some time with my daughter. And then in the evening, I sometimes do some business stuff.
Sure. Okay, interesting. Yeah, it's that creative freedom and the freedom to just kind of wake up and literally do music. And maybe you don't want to do music that day. You don't feel like it. You're not feeling like it. And you don't have to.
Yeah, but there's never a day now that I don't make music. That's interesting. Sure. Because I really got back to the kind of, you know, it's standing up at 5:30 and then having the morning routine stuff. And then I always make music. There's no, like, it's never for me. Not right now, for example, I want to finish my album. I give myself deadlines because otherwise I don't feel that well. So for me, I'm pretty structured once again. And I also give my, nobody else is giving me deadlines, right? There's, and I'm totally, I get angry whenever anybody tries that. Like some people at work, like the, I don't know, like when I have like a PR or a press or my management, whenever like, oh, we need this. I'm like,
I'm done with that.
Yeah, I'm done with that.
I was done with that 7 years ago.
Exactly. I make the deadlines. Nobody else makes the deadlines. It's my music. Yeah. So, but I give myself deadlines just to finish stuff, just because it feels better. Because, you know, just slouching around, that's not very fulfilling. So I find it really fulfilling to have a schedule to say, okay, this is what I'm going to do. This is the what I'm producing. And I just have a lot of fun also doing that. And I feel better being structured and having a clear vision. If I would just, you know, sleep through every day and then stand up and say, what am I going to do today? It just doesn't feel good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, incredible. So how many songs have you written over the years?
Over the years, hard to tell. Probably around 1,000.
Okay. Wow. So what, kind of the last question here, what advice would you give to a producer that, you know, maybe even looking back 15, 20, 30 years on your career, what advice would you give to the younger self at the end of the day, make a living on music?
Kind of boring advice. Focus on your music. I get way too many questions where people ask me how to make it, you know, how to become successful. You become successful by making outstanding music. That's it. I'm on purpose not saying good music or better music because I don't like it. It's, you know, it's, you have to make music that works in the end. So I don't want to be judging there and saying that all music that's successful are better because there's... Yeah, the difference is some people make music that a smaller group of people feels very intensely, and some people make music that a broader group of people feel pretty good about. So then when you look at the numbers, the person that a lot of people, that reaches a lot of people, he has like bigger numbers, or she has bigger numbers than the person that has less smaller numbers, but maybe the connection is more intense. So yeah, it's not all about the numbers, but success comes from your product there, at least in my opinion. And it's easy when you have great music. It's everything else comes automatically. So just focus on that. It's so boring advice, I know, but it's the best advice I can give. It's just that. Sure. Try and get better. Because a lot of people think they're like, oh, I'm at the point now where I almost sound like the stuff that's out there that's successful. Why am I not successful? Well, because you have to change the game. You have to create something new. You have to create something very unique, something that's disruptive. That's important. Make something, when people hear it, they're like, wait, what's that? That's the thing you need. And then they have to be like, no, oh, what's that? That sounds horrible. But wow, what's that? That sounds amazing. You need that. You need to be really outstanding. And then everything else will come. And just focus on that. Just focus on the music. Not on all the, especially the promotion stuff. I see so many people trying to come up with like crazy social media promotion plans, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Telling me about it and then executing it and nothing happens. Yeah, because, you know, if the music's not there, it's not gonna do anything.
It's a good point. It's like when people say, it's like, I want to be the next Fat Rat. Well, why? We already have one. Why not be something else?
Yeah.
The Fat Rat is already doing his thing. Lady Gaga's done her thing. They're all doing their own thing. We don't need another Lady Gaga. Yeah. We need the next, you know, Beyonce. We need somebody that's going to carve out, like you said, that space and be unique.
Yeah. And that's takes a little courage to do that.
Yes.
Because you need to do something that doesn't feel safe. You need to do something where you feel like, oh, I have no idea how people are going to react to that because nobody has done that before. Because if you go around where like, oh, that sounds like, let's say, future-based, typical future bass or whatever it might be, or EDM, it just sounds like 100 people, other people, then you know how people are going to react. And what I do also with the album, I have some songs on it where I'm like, maybe everybody's going to hate it because it's so different. But then that's the risk that you have to take. If you're not afraid of putting it out because it's different and you feel like, oh, I have no idea how people are going to react to it, then it's at least I can only encourage people to do that. And I was kind of scared when I put out Unity because it was so different. Also, then the remixes and everything else that I had done before, because it was so melodic. Everything about it was so different. I was like, oh, I expected half of the people to hate it. And I thought, okay, maybe because I loved it, maybe other people are going to love it as well, but maybe a lot of people are going to be like, well, what's that? But that's where you can develop. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Good advice. Simple, but straight to the point and focus on your music. Yeah. That's so, so great. Well, that's all the questions that I have. Thank you so much, Christian Fat Rat. Again, I have so many memories of listening to your music, so it's been an honor speaking with you and being able to interview you. And I'll continue supporting you, looking forward to the album. And keep making great music.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks again, and take care out there.
Bye-bye.
Bye.